Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A birth control delivery startup has accused pharmacy benefits manager CVS Caremark of cutting payment rates for mail order birth control pills, making it more expensive and potentially out of reach for women who rely on delivery. The feud has spawned the trending hashtag CVS denies care and shined a light on the issue of cost and accessibility of birth control in the U.S., where more than 19 million women report living in an area without access to contraceptives. New York-based journalist Garnet Henderson wrote about the issue for Vice. We'll post a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides. Garnet Henderson, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Pill Club is a mail order birth control service. CVS Caremark is a pharmacy benefits manager. What's the connection in this story?
Well, pharmacy benefit managers are something I think a lot of people don't even realize exist. They're third-party companies that contract with health insurers, and they negotiate what a health insurance plan is going to pay for certain drugs, and then they negotiate with pharmacies how much the pharmacy is going to be reimbursed for dispensing those drugs. And so CVS says that it has cut, or rather, it has changed its reimbursement policies for all pharmacies with a similar business model to Pill Club. So in other words, that's mail order pharmacies. And Pill Club says that with these new reimbursement rates, it can no longer afford to continue serving patients who have CVS Caremark.
Why are they going after the mail order operations?
Well, a very likely explanation could be that CVS Caremark actually has its own mail order prescription service. So it's highly likely that they're doing this just to cut down on competition. But one thing that is different is Pill Club, Nurex, Pandia, several of these birth control focused online startups also provide telemedicine. So if you don't have a prescription for birth control, you can also get a prescription by chatting with a doctor via their app or their website, which is different, whereas with other mail order prescription services, you already need to have a prescription.
You know, I guess what I learned from preparing for this whole thing is that there are specialized mail order birth control services. When did that become a thing and why?
That's right. This has become a very big trend just within the last few years in recognition of the fact that a lot of people struggle to access birth control, in particular because there can be stigma surrounding use of contraceptives. It can be something that people have privacy concerns around. And then also, especially for people who live in rural areas, they may live very far from the nearest doctor, or they may not have a lot of options in terms of which doctors they can see in their area. And for them, it feels easier or more comfortable to be able to do this all via telemedicine. And that applies as well for people with disabilities who may have trouble actually getting to a doctor.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Garnet Henderson, who's written about the issue of pricing for mail-order birth control operations by CVS Caremark, the pharmacy benefit manager that is setting the rates. It's casting a brighter light on the issue of birth control contraception in the United States writ large. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at All Sides at WOSU.org. We know 19 million women in the U.S. still struggle with access to affordable birth control, but it's not just affordable, it's also available, accessible birth control, as you said. The telemedicine piece of this is really important. But is Pill Club all and others like it, are they also serving women who are low income and uninsured?
They do. Pill Club in particular says that about 70% of its users report previously struggling to access birth control, and about 55% of them say that they would fall off of birth control if it weren't for Pill Club. So another reason why these online services have become so popular is they do have affordable options for people who are either underinsured or uninsured, because that telemedicine consult with a doctor only costs about $20 or $30 usually, which is far cheaper than paying out of pocket for someone who doesn't have insurance. And it may even be cheaper than a copay for someone who does have insurance. And most people now under the Affordable Care Act are able to get birth control with no copay. So in other words, it should be free. Although there are employers who can opt out of providing contraceptive coverage. And in fact, the Trump administration has made it easier for employers to opt out for religious reasons. And so these online birth control startups serve a lot of those people, either who don't have insurance and therefore are paying out of pocket, or don't have good contraceptive coverage, even if they do have insurance.
How much do contraceptives cost these days?
Well, there are some really cheap options, especially with Pill Club, that I think you can get for, you know, only about $5 a month from a lot of these online pharmacies. But birth control can cost $30, even $60 or more dollars a month, depending on what method a person uses, because there are lots of different kinds of birth control pills, and different pills have different benefits and different drawbacks. So the right pill for each person may not necessarily be the cheapest one.
And also, not everybody uses birth control as a contraceptive. It's for other purposes as well, right?
Correct. Yeah, lots of people use birth control to help manage endometriosis and other serious period pains, acne, and a number of other health issues too, like ovarian cysts.
When we talk about women living in contraceptive deserts, though, what does that mean? I mean, is that kind of like when we describe food deserts where people don't live close enough to a grocery store and that kind of a thing?
Usually that's the case, yeah. It means that people are living very far from the nearest doctor, or the options in their area don't include a full range of contraceptive services. So that could mean, you know, a small pharmacy that only stocks a few kinds of birth control pill instead of the dozens that you would find at a pharmacy in a larger city. And, you know, there are lots of other contraceptive options as well that are not the pill. There's the Nuva ring, there's the patch, there's the shot, and now they're increasingly popular. There are implants and IUDs, intrauterine devices, but not all doctors are trained in inserting those implants and IUDs, and so that's another thing that contributes to that contraceptive desert.
As far as the demand for birth control, is it pretty stable across the country, or has it gone up or down? Do we know anything about that?
Well, the demand, I would say, is pretty stable, but we do know that birth control is becoming harder to access, in part because I mentioned the Trump administration has made it easier for employers to opt out of coverage. And the Trump administration has also made changes to Title 10, which is the federal family planning program. So Planned Parenthood has been in the news this week because it announced that it was going to opt out of Title 10 rather than comply with what's called the gag rule, which is a requirement that Title 10 providers not even be able to discuss abortion as a pregnancy option with patients, even if the patient brings it up. So Planned Parenthood, as well as a number of other Title 10 funded health centers, are pulling out. And that means that people who rely on those Title 10 funds to help them afford their birth control are now going to have fewer options of where they can go. So that, again, is something that exacerbates this issue of contraceptive deserts.
Is the Pill Club in this fight alone against CVS Caremark, or are there other providers that are working on this?
I spoke to Pandia Health, which is a very similar company to Pill Club. It's focused entirely on birth control, and they said that they have been affected by these changes. They have not said that they're going to stop taking CVS Caremark yet, but they did confirm to me that they're affected by this. I reached out to a couple of other similar startups. NewRx is probably another main name that people know if they're familiar with these services. And they told me that they didn't have any news to share about any changes. So they wouldn't confirm whether or not they had been affected by the change. But if they are, I suppose they've just decided that they're going to accept these new reimbursement terms from CVS.
What's our understanding about a tipping point for affordability when it comes to something like contraceptives?
Well, I think that depends a lot on a person's income. Mm-hmm. You know, for some people, paying an extra $30 a month for birth control, maybe if they don't have good contraceptive coverage, say they have one of those employers who opt out for religious reasons, maybe wouldn't be that big of a deal. But for some people, you know, it might be a question of, do I have $30 to spend on my birth control, or do I need to spend this $30 on my rent or food or gas? So we know that this is primarily an issue for low-income women. More of those women are going to be living in rural areas, and more of those women are also going to be women of color.
And, you know, you mentioned about some companies being able to opt out of birth control coverage for religious reasons. When you're saying opting out, you're saying opting out of the Affordable Care Act. What did it originally cover when it came to birth control?
So the Affordable Care Act was a huge step forward in terms of contraceptive coverage in the United States, because it required that pretty much all health plans cover an entire range of contraceptive services. So essentially, whatever method you choose, the pill, the patch, the ring, IUD, implant, it should all be covered. But this has been a big issue. There have been several legal challenges to that contraceptive mandate, which did result in giving religious organizations slightly more leeway to refuse contraceptive coverage for their employees. And the Trump administration has also changed some rules to make it easier for employers to opt out. And this includes employers that aren't religious organizations like churches, but just other corporations that for religious reasons do not want to cover contraceptives.
And I don't think this was covered in your reporting, Garnet Henderson, but I was wondering if you could give us a sense about how the U.S. stacks up against other Western industrialized, you know, first world nations.
Sure. When it comes to reproductive health care, unfortunately, here in the U.S., we are quite behind. In other Western countries, free or affordable birth control is pretty much standard, especially in those countries that have socialized medicine, right, where no one is paying a copay for anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it, Garnet. Take care.
Thank you.
That's Garnet Henderson. She's a New York-based journalist covering health and abortion access. She wrote about a feud between a birth control delivery startup and the pharmacy benefits manager CVS Caremark. We've talked about them a lot on All Sides over the last several months for how they manage the job of pharmacy benefits manager. We will post a link to Garnet Henderson's article at our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The nonprofit Emerald Jenny Foundation was created in 2017 to help people struggling with addiction find treatment in Ohio. The foundation since then has reached 120,000 people. Bill Ayers founded the Emerald Jenny Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the foundation and how it got started.
Well, when you go through the unimaginable, the loss of your daughter, and you reflect on the trouble we had finding available resources, we decided our mission was to help people so they wouldn't go through the same pain and suffering we went through looking for help.
I'm sorry about your daughter, and could you tell us what was your experience in finding treatment for her?
Well, it was very difficult at that time, and you have to go back a few years in time. Really, you couldn't talk to really anybody about that problem. You know, the healthcare providers really didn't know the treatment options available, and you know, it was hard to talk to friends and family about it. So you were left really to find, to track down resources on your own. And it was very confusing, and there wasn't a simple place to go that showed you what was available in your area.
So you would go to your family physician, for example, and they just kind of threw their hands up and said they didn't know?
Well, Jennifer was 28, and once she turned 18, you know, you have that privacy issue, and she was really trying. This had been an ongoing problem for her, but she seemed to get it under control, and we all felt good about it, and then she would sort of slip. Mm-hmm. And part of that time, she had lived in Arizona, so she wasn't right here. So we struggled to keep tabs on how well she was doing.
How does Emerald Jenny work? What's the process?
Well, what someone who's looking for help or a family member can go on to the site, and you can pick a location, and then you can begin to filter by male, female, adult, child. And then there are additional filters that help narrow down to available resources in your area.
This sounds like something maybe the state should be doing.
Well, we are working with the state. They actually, the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services now uses, if you go to their website, mm-hmm. it goes directly to our site, and which is amazing because for them to have the confidence in what we're doing is pretty amazing for us. But we really believe we pulled together the best available resource covering the entire state of Ohio.
I imagine that there are shifting sands. There has been issues about not with your program, not with your site, but with some service providers out there. How do you vet for your site?
Well, we call each provider every 6 months. Our mission is to make it the most comprehensive and the most accurate. So we have a team of four people who really are on the phone all the time, just keeping track of what available resources are there. You know, groups combine with each other. Some go out of business. There's a lot of shifting sand. So it's a major effort to keep this as accurate as possible.
And, yeah, there are new service providers all the time. How does Ohio stack up in terms of that compared to other states? What do you know?
Personally, I don't have an answer to that. We focus entirely on helping Ohioans seek treatment. So it's a good question, but I would have to get back to you on that.
Have you learned anything from other organizations in other states, or did you start completely from scratch?
When we started completely from scratch, thinking of this from a family's perspective. The terminology can get very complicated. It's just very difficult. We didn't know what drugs Jennifer was using, and even if we did, we may not understand all the, how that influences things. So what we did was we wanted to keep it simple enough so any family member could at least get the process started of finding help for their loved one.
What is your recommendation for people who are related to somebody or a loved one of somebody struggling with addiction? What were the signs for you?
It came via family members. I, being the father, it's that balance between when kids are just going out and partying and when they've gone over the edge. And it was really my fiance who grabbed me by the hair and said, look, this is a bigger problem than you think it is. And so sometimes somebody close to you, you may not see it. And I was always very positive and upbeat, thinking, well, she can get control of this. And obviously I was wrong, and I'm just hoping to help others not go through what we went through.
And with somebody goes on to Emerald Jenny, and of course we will post a link to that website on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. When they go on, what you say they first go on and they can, how does the experience work?
The first thing you do is you put in a location, and it defaults to 10 miles from where you are. You can expand that to 25 miles or even farther. And then you begin to look at the filters. Are you looking for alcohol, drug addiction, or we have a filter for opiate specific? And then you get into male, female, adult, child. And then we have, even though people may not know exactly what they need, you know, we have filters for like detox or residential treatment, and we have added homeless shelters and recovery residences as well. But the big key is someone, you really need an assessment, and you need the professional help to help you understand what the proper need is for your loved one.
Are you confident that there are enough treatment centers now to treat everybody? I mean, when you're talking about a 10 or 25 mile radius, for people in rural areas, there's nothing like that around, is there?
We discovered that as we were pulling the site together. Once we finished the metropolitan areas, there it feels like there's big gaps in the rural communities. And that was sort of a surprise, because once we set out the mission to complete the entire state, once we finished the major cities, the rest of the state fell into place pretty easily. Now, we do list, in addition to those items, we've tracked down as much in each county that we can find. Like, we list the Adams boards, we list the 211 numbers, and we're continuing to discover new treatment programs that are built to help people.
Can you discern what people are looking for the most?
We are just getting into the analytics. Our site is anonymous, so we do not track people.
Mm-hmm.
The other item is it's free. It's, you know, we're not trying to make any money on this. That said, we are just beginning the process of looking at the analytics to see which type of services are requested most. So I don't have an update for you on that, but it's something that we're getting into now.
Well, Bill Ayers, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Ann, and have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Bill Ayers, he's founder of the Emerald Jenny Foundation. That's a nonprofit created in 2017 to help those struggling with addiction find the services that can help them recover. For more information, you could check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Most of what influences a person's health has nothing to do with clinical care. That is, it has nothing to do with whether you see a doctor or not. Food, housing, and transportation have much more of an impact. And to that end, United Healthcare is awarding more than $1 million in grants to several statewide organizations to address those issues. The recipient of the biggest grant is the Ohio Association of Food Banks. Lisa Hamler-Fugit is the executive director. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
And Tracy Davidson is the vice president of quality and population health strategy at United Healthcare. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
What inspired this? Why now?
Oh, why now? Well, we know that, as you mentioned earlier, Ann, health has a lot more to do with the non-medical traditional activities that we hear about most often. And so we know that empowering our communities is really where the answer lies in helping them to be most effective.
Huh. And so the amount is $1.1 million. What was the magic in that number?
Actually, looking at the special needs of our communities is what helped us identify key initiatives that were going to help empower communities, like I mentioned. The Ohio Association of Food Banks is the recipient of a $500 million. Wouldn't you be excited about that, Lisa?
She's not that excited.
Half million, excuse me, of those dollars. And the other agencies that are receiving those grants are our Helen Keller International Foundation, the senior services up in our Cleveland market. And what we're looking at is how we can empower those agencies to continue to connect with their communities to provide services and needs to the local areas.
United Healthcare is going to help link those four nonprofits? How so?
Yeah, actually, these grants are an opportunity for community organizations to work together collaboratively to connect all of the activities that are happening in our local areas. What we find is that many organizations are doing all the right things, and as we can bring them together to talk about the work that they're doing, that work can go farther.
Yeah, Lisa Hamler, if you get that, makes sense to you?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been partnering with the healthcare industry since the beginning of Medicare Part D. We know far too many of those who are turning to our food banks, food pantries, and soup kitchens are making trade-offs every day between food and medicine or medical care. So this is a natural collaborative, and we are just so grateful and fortunate to have received this investment at a time that we really need to increase our capacity to get more fresh fruits, vegetables, and lean protein items out to a growing number of Ohioans who are making those difficult choices.
I know just the, you know, how food banks operate nowadays has changed so much over the years. And it's happening, you know, it's the same thing that's happening in schools and so many other touchstones in a community. They're more wraparound services now, right?
That's correct. And investments like United Healthcare is making allows us to really scale and increase our capacity to provide in a very coordinated and consolidated way, more services to people, reaching them where they work, live, play, pray, and learn.
Why did Part D make a difference? Why is that a tipping point?
Well, that's when Ohio Food Banks really became involved in not only advocacy, but outreaching to our clients' access to health care with more seniors. We saw, again, seniors living on low fixed incomes as they do today. They did back then. Who did not have the resources or the money to be able to buy their life-sustaining medications. So we began outreaching at that time and have really built on that through expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program to today, the work that we're doing around the Affordable Care Act, but more particularly around expansion of Medicaid and working in partnership with United Healthcare as a managed care organization.
I would imagine that most of the people that the Ohio Association of Food Banks deal with, all things being equal, aren't your clients.
No, and you're right about that. And that's what's so exciting about the opportunity to empower communities. This isn't about a United Healthcare marketing campaign. This is really about us understanding the unique needs of where we live, work, and play, and how we are going to invest in communities becoming healthier and stronger. We serve over 2 million Ohioans that carry a UnitedHealthcare card. That's about 1 in 5 Buckeyes that carry our card. And so they live everywhere. They play and work and pray everywhere, as Lisa mentioned. And we employ over 4,000 Ohioans. So this is real for us. This is how we show up every day. Our mission is to help people live healthier lives and to make the healthcare system work for everyone. That's not just the people that carry our card.
Right. The people that carry your card, by and large, are not older Ohioans because they're covered by Medicare, but they can get partial insurance coverage from UnitedHealthcare, right?
Actually, we cover three lines of business here in the state of Ohio. We have our government sector, which is actually our Medicaid program, covers over 300,000 Ohioans. We have our Medicare program, which is upwards of probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 or plus, as well as then our commercial coverage, which is those that are employed who receive it through their employer group. So over 2 million Ohioans that carry the UnitedHealthcare card.
Lisa Hamill, if you get the issue of older Ohioans. Can you talk about what the numbers are and how they've changed or grown or shrunk over time, maybe?
It's an epidemic. I mean, we are an aging state, and just completed the fourth quarter data, the June 30 ending data. We served 489,000 persons over the age of 60 just through food pantries alone in the 3 months, April, May, and June. Many more seniors who are reporting that they are primary caregivers for grandchildren and great-grandchildren who they have taken in, seniors living on very low fixed incomes, some still trying to straddle a part-time job. Reentry into the workforce is a lot of it. But again, this is about hunger and food insecurity, and it's a lot of populations, whether they're working or unemployed, senior citizens, persons with disability, veterans, who are making those difficult trade-offs because of the rapidly rising cost of living. And the most fungible portion of anybody's budget that they have to spend is on food, and that's being sacrificed.
You know, Tracy Davidson, the issues surround, you know, the issues that influence a person's health outside of the clinical setting, food, housing, transportation, what else?
I think social isolation and being connected to our communities. One of the grants actually that we provided in the Cleveland community is around connecting seniors and making sure, to Lisa's point earlier, that they have the services and the connections in the communities that they are living. They are on fixed incomes. They do have different needs than their neighbors. And so one of the grants is actually looking at transportation so that they can continue to get out into the community and be not isolated.
You know, when I think about food banks these days, Lisa, I really think of like a community center almost. They're so much more than just lining up for a bag of food.
They are. I mean, we have transformed. It's pretty unbelievable. Our 12 food banks are now massive food depositories. We're providing food and other resources, including funding and training and technical assistance and programming to 3,571 member charities. They've become the hub. We're hosting a full gamut of services and provisions. We're now expanding into what we call non-traditional service delivery operations. We have opened more school-based food pantries in kindergarten through 12th grade and higher education, community colleges, four-year institutions. We are now in healthcare clinics. Just anywhere that folks live we all have to eat. So, again, we cannot take for granted that our friends and neighbors have the resources they need. The other thing that's really impacting us is the continuing consolidation of retail grocery stores. It's not just an urban problem. It's a rural and a suburban problem as well, with more food deserts. So again, getting food to people where they live is really important, and into trusted communities at which they turn. And this grant with UnitedHealthcare has provided us with the opportunity to expand the infrastructure. Again, getting more fresh fruits and vegetables into the agencies and into the communities.
So how are you collaborating with these other groups? What will you be doing?
They're member charities. It's our partnership is to get them more food so they can serve more people and really concentrate on the core work that they do, whether it's social service delivery. So again, more point in time delivery. We're buying refrigerated trucks to get more food into the communities, more refrigeration and more freezer space as well. But the great part about this collaboration is not only have they made the investment, that we were able to leverage that and match it with a small state appropriation of additional $500,000. So we're going to be literally doubling our efforts to get more refrigerators and freezers out to our community-based organizations.
This is telling me that this isn't shrinking. I mean, you're calling it an epidemic. It's, you know, I've been talking to you for 20-odd years now about these issues, and it's not a question of ending it.
No. And what we continue to see is the haves have a lot and the have-nots have very little. And it's this growing income inequity that we see. I mean, again, we are now full 10 years into a recovery. There are 3.7 million Ohioans, one in three Ohioans, who do not earn enough to be able to meet their basic needs. And about half of those folks don't qualify for any other program. They're considered the working poor. So again, as rapidly rising housing costs, healthcare costs, transportation costs continue to go up, it's the food budget that's being sacrificed.
The America's Health Rankings by United Health Foundation, Healthcare Foundation, Ohio ranked 40th in the analysis of community and environmental conditions. It's policies, clinical care, and outcomes. So Ohio is lagging behind too,
yes.
Right, Tracy?
Yes, we are. And actually, Lisa and I were talking about that before we came in, about being 40th. Ohio likes to be first in a lot of the things that we're doing as a very proud state. And to be a lagger in that bottom 10 of health outcomes is telling. And so we have an opportunity to improve policy. We have an opportunity to look at the numbers that Lisa was just referencing. And again, thinking about how we want to make sure that where we live, work, and play is healthy for new businesses that want to come into Ohio, as well as investments in our local communities.
Lisa Hamler, what do you make of that 40th ranking? I mean, what, you know, given your breadth of experience, what is it about how Ohio operates that is it the Rust Belt legacy? Is it, what is it? Is it the aging population?
I think it's a combination of all of those. Certainly, we are an aging state. It's the wages. We just have not seen a wage recovery. The family supporting benefit providing jobs that were lost during the Great Recession have been replaced with part-time, temporary, low-wage contingent employment. I mean, we have 8 of the 10 most prevalent occupations in the state of Ohio don't provide living wages, which is a real problem. And it's our public policy. I mean, quite frankly, when we see these kind of health rankings, we have seen a massive exodus in the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as the food stamp program. Mm-hmm. What's contributing to that? Well, a lot of it's policy. We're now saying that if you're between the ages of 18 and 49 and you're not employed 20 hours a week or engaged in an employment and training program, then you can only get food stamps for 3 months out of every 36-month
period. Is this
period.
The new policy that just went into effect?
This is a policy that has been into effect. But again, Ohio has not exercised the waivers. We've seen some pretty draconian public policy at the state level that really limits access to the first line of defense against hunger, and that's the SNAP benefit. It's very difficult for individuals to maintain their SNAP eligibility when they're working multiple part-time jobs and need to go down to the County Department of Job and Family Services, or who lack access to technology is a big issue as well. Because now that so many of our social services have been moved online, people take it for granted that they have access to internet, and they don't.
Yeah. And our Southern Ohio communities, we don't have internet.
Right.
And so we really need to think about how we show up differently in those communities to make sure people do have the access that they deserve. I think one of the things that Lisa mentioned is capacity building. Mm-hmm. And when I think about investment, that's really what United has been doing with our Empowering Health Grants. It's looking at capacity building. So we've provided capacity for the food banks to be able to leverage food trucks and refrigeration, et cetera, to scale and get more food out to more people. And parallel to that is the Celebrate One grant that we completed a couple of years ago here in central Ohio, were over $1 million, actually $1.7 million, tackling black infant mortality and really providing the infrastructure to train 72 community health workers to be living in and working in the communities that have the highest rate of black infant mortality. Again, the commitment here that I'm trying to talk through is the investment in capacity and how do we help communities develop more capacity to do the work that needs to be done.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Illinois announced this month that it's going to be investing $1 million in housing and wraparound support services for mm-hmm. members of Chicago's homeless community. Mm-hmm. I guess this is a trend in your industry.
Mm-hmm. It is. And when we think about, again, the connection to health and well-being, stable housing and food security are key pillars to that. When you know where you're going to live and that you have a roof over your head and a stable place to come to and rest every night, the well-being part of health and wellness really becomes true. A couple of years ago, we actually invested over $9 million in Dayton in an affordable housing neighborhood. And those kinds, again, investments in flourishing communities allow people to be connected and to be able to access the things that they need to be more successful, employable, food secure, connected, not isolated. And that's when communities flourish.
Hmm. And Lisa, What do you think? I mean, when we talk about who's at the biggest risk, we've talked a lot about older Ohioans, but you're saying that it's not just older Ohioans now.
No. And again, you know, we pay a horribly high cost for hunger. And most of that cost is born in lost productivity, but it's rapidly rising healthcare cost in the need to treat chronic and diet-related diseases. So many of the folks who stand in our food lines are suffering from chronic diseases, primarily diabetes. And again, it's the trade-offs that they're making. I mean, I just pulled some data. The cost of food insecurity alone in the state of Ohio is nearly $2.4 billion a year. So it's time that we make these investments in addressing the social determinants of health, including making sure that people have their basic needs met. And we're going to see a reduction in the overall cost of healthcare. And that's what we need to do. We need to put our money and invest our money in the right places, in prevention, not trying to treat the disease.
That's something they've been working at the Medicaid department in Ohio. Are you familiar with what they're doing and whether or not it's playing out in the way they hoped?
I think that it's an evolving process. There's a request for information, request for proposal out now, looking at how we can do more wraparound services. To be quite honest, we need to ensure that both Medicaid and Medicare provide for the reimbursement of food. Food is medicine, food is health.
Yeah.
And again, we're working on these programs as philanthropic initiatives. We need a payer source. We want people standing in grocery store checkout lines mm-hmm. instead of food pantry and soup kitchen lines. That's the that's our bottom line.
And if there was reimbursement, that would be possible.
Absolutely.
Right.
And then as far as housing insecurity goes, Lisa, how many of the people that visit the food banks across Ohio are also housing insecure? So that means even if they do have a place they're staying, they may not have a place to cook in. It's complex.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of doubling and tripling up again because that I think states' low incomes and higher rents and mortgage costs are a big issue for us. We'd say at any time 20-30% are housing insecure, again, because they're making those trade-offs. And again, we need more affordable housing, not less. We see Franklin County and the city of Columbus making more investments in that. That's a long-term commitment.
Finally.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. Yeah. I mean, it's taken a long time.
Yeah.
I'm also really curious to see what's going to come out of this next census, and concerned because of all the controversy around the census. But what are you going to be looking at, Tracy Davidson, coming up?
Yeah, I think from a census perspective, it's really about geographical penetration and mm-hmm. really understanding the specific needs of where people are so that we can then target some of these community engagements that we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes. we can look at what we call hotspotting and use data or data to really drive where we find the most opportunity and the most individuals who are at risk that need our support. And so I think the census will help us do that. Lisa mentioned a little bit about the cost of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, within our industry, looking at bringing down the total cost of care is what is most powerful so that employers can flourish more, individuals can have more money in their pockets and not spending them on things like medicines and doctor's appointments. And so I think what I'm going to be looking for is really where are we seeing any changes in demographics, that any changes in the concentration of where people and their needs are, that will drive some changes in how we might behave and invest as well.
What about you, Lisa?
Really pleased and want to thank Governor DeWine for pulling together the 2020 Census Commission. I'll be serving on that. This is going to be my third census that will be working. Everyone needs to be counted, the bottom line. And that if you're not counted, then you don't have a voice, you won't have representation, and your community will not have the resources that it needs. Literally billions of dollars are at stake, and everyone must be counted. And it's all hands on deck at this point. We need everyone involved, both foundations, corporations, nonprofits. All communities need to be engaged to make sure that everyone's counted.
A lot of times people ask this very prosaic question that I'm sure you've heard 1,000 times, how can I help? That's changed over time.
It is. And again, because the census and the enumeration is going to be done online, we need people that are in churches and synagogues or community-based organizations asking their friends and neighbors, have you been counted? Do you need help completing the census form? Do you know what the census form means? Again, we want a buzz. We want to really create a buzz to make sure that everybody's involved. It's like voting. You've got to be counted in this process. So we're going to be reaching out, and we're really behind schedule. I mean, the federal government has put very few resources in the organizing and the capacity that we really need to deploy the enumerators.
Tracy Davidson, I wondered about the Helen Keller International and what they're doing, what their grant was, and what they're going to be doing with this.
Yeah, they're actually looking at how they can provide additional screenings for vision as well as glasses and comprehensive visual services. If we think about access in a community, just like transportation, people need to have transportation to get to their doctor. People need to be able to see to participate in their daily life. And so the Helen Keller Foundation is actually looking at expanding more screenings, more contacts, more glasses, so that we can help people continue to participate in their daily work and daily lives.
When you put out this request for applications for these grants, what surprised you about the responses?
I think that we're still having this conversation, especially about food. I think that the fact
it surprised you that this these are still
that
issues.
That these are still the issues that we're dealing with. Social isolation. I actually can say that word. The opportunity to be transported to a place that you want to go and have access to it, to be able to be food secure, to even have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, that we're still having this conversation in almost 2020 is what still surprises me to my core.
Well, Tracy Davidson, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Tracy Davidson. She's Vice President of Quality and Population Health Strategy at United Healthcare. United Healthcare has awarded more than $1 million in grants to several statewide organizations to help address the issues of food, housing, and transportation, things that aren't related to a doctor's office but very much influence a person's health. One of the beneficiaries of those grants is the Ohio Association of Food Banks. And Lisa Hamiller-Fugit, thanks for your time today as well.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you for your interest. This is a really important topic.
Lisa Hamiller-Fugit, she's Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks. Thanks so much for listening today. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.